This is Dave the Game Chalker, winner of the Origins Award for Best Family, Children's, or Party Game, and you are listening to the Rule Zero Podcast.
From the Rule Zero Studios in High Bar Zoom, this is Rule Zero, the podcast for gamers to talk about gaming. All games, all gaming, all the time. Welcome to the conversation.
Welcome back to Rule Zero. Kickstart my heart, I'm Chris, and I believe them bones are me.
And tickle my fancy, I'm Pete. Them bones over are not me.
But we are back for another rousing episode
indeed,
of Rule Zero.
In spite of the fact that I'm apparently a gelatinous mass.
Oh, that's sad to hear.
It's okay.
But I have wonderful news.
Yes,
I have
do.
Played Marvel.
And I'm so ticked off with you because I'm gagging to play that.
You're going to love it.
Oh, I'm just going to give you such a pinch the next time I see you.
Well, promise is promise. I really got to see the system and how it runs.
Fantastic.
Dave Chalker ran it for us.
Very nice.
And that's Dave the Game on Twitter. And I really enjoyed how the game was set up, because in this version, this is like the first superhero game that I've played where someone like Captain America or Hawkeye can play alongside someone like Thor or the Silver Surfer, and neither one of them is going to like overwhelm the other with awesomeness.
Fantastic. I'm so happy to hear that.
Because everybody has the same kind of number of dice pools to choose from.
Nice.
And to draw from, and it's a matter of, it's kind of like Spirit of the Century, where you invoke certain things to add to your ability.
Right.
You want a rundown of the system?
Yeah.
Okay. The basic combat mechanic is when you do any action, it could be a combat or it could be like a skill check. But whatever you do, you pick dice from each of these sections of your character sheet.
Right.
Like I'm looking at Daredevil right now, and he's got the you first choose a die from your affiliation, and you could be solo, buddy, or team. So if Daredevil is by himself, he uses a D10 from this pool.
Okay.
If he's on a team, he uses a D6 because Daredevil, he doesn't really play on a team very often.
What if you're doing like a Marvel team up and it's a
That would be a buddy. That would be a D8.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
So everybody has a solo, a buddy, and team affiliation, and those are the ranks of how they work best.
Nice.
So Daredevil works best alone, so his solo die is a D10.
Gotcha.
Then you choose from your distinctions.
Okay.
And, for example, Daredevils are Blind Justice, uh-huh. Man Without Fear, uh-huh. and Protector of Hell's Kitchen.
And super fast in spite of being blind. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No, sorry, that hurts.
That's actually not... But you could probably add that if you wanted to remove one of his other distinctions.
No, I was mentioning that because we brought that up in Undies on the Outside, so...
Yeah, I know. It's. Yeah. I mean, we're looking at Daredevil here, and, he's got the same kinds of dice as Mr. Fantastic or... I haven't seen the Silver Surfer statted out, but, any of the other, they've all got the same kinds of dice pools to use.
Right. What about when you have enemies? Do they have similar dice pools, or?
I'll get to that.
Okay,
to that.
Sorry. Go ahead.
So your distinctions, you're either choosing a D4 or a D8, and you get to choose which one you use.
Nice.
But if you choose the D4, you're using one of your distinctions in a bad way. Like, you could be Protector of Hell's Kitchen, so you want to use the D4 because you have to do this because it's threatening your area.
Okay.
So you use the D4, but when you use the D4, the GM gives you a plot point.
Nice.
That's something you can invoke later. And these
plot
are,
points
the same...
are currency to do awesome things later.
Yeah,
gotcha.
It's pretty much I mean, a lot of games use it. We've talked about them before,
it's
not that different from any of the other ones.
Yep.
So then you've got power sets, and many of the heroes have two power sets, and some of them only have one. I haven't seen any heroes that have three power sets.
Okay.
But you can choose a die from each of your power sets if they apply to the situation.
Okay.
So his Billy Club power set has enhanced durability at a D8, weapon as a D6, and swing line as a D6.
Okay, I'm with you.
And his Hyper Senses power set says enhanced reflexes D8, superhuman senses D10, and enhanced stamina, D8. So if he wants to use his Billy Club as a weapon to hit something that's moving very quickly, he would use the weapon die, which is a D6, and the enhanced reflexes, which is a D8. So both of those dice would be added to his dice pool.
Oh, okay.
And if this were, say, a combat move. His next section is called specialties, and he's got six specialties. And those are basically skills.
Okay, gotcha.
He would choose the one labeled combat expert at a D8, because this is a combat move.
Okay.
So now you've got a D10, a D4, a D6, a D10, I'm sorry, a D8, and a D8 added to your dice pool. So he wants to hit something, he's decided, you know, and you say what you need to do.
Okay.
And there actually encourages you in the rules to tell the GM what happens if you fail.
Oh, great.
But
I like it.
Yeah, between the player and the GM, it's kind of worked out what happens, you know, if you make it or if you pass or fail.
Uh-huh.
So you roll all the dice in your dice pool, and you pick the highest two and add them together. And that's your score. That's the number you made.
Okay.
And you choose any of the other dice in the dice pool, and that is your effect die. And you want to use a higher one. So I think we had all D8s in that, didn't we?
I think so.
Okay. So the solo die was a D10.
Oh, right. Right.
So let's say the solo die or the D10 only rolled a 1.
Okay.
Actually, we'll come back to 1s. Let's say it rolled a 2.
Okay.
So that's one of your lower numbers. You've got two of your 8-siders that made a 16. You want to use your solo die, your D10,
mm-hmm.
as your effect die, because that means that if your effect is more powerful, it doesn't matter what number's showing on the dice.
But it's more powerful because it's a D10. So it's not the result, it's the size of the die.
That is correct.
Okay.
Size matters.
Zip.
So then the target of that maneuver rolls many, you know, adds up the types of defenses that he can get from the same kinds of dice pools.
Right.
And he rolls his dice, and it's a contested roll.
Okay.
Now, if the hero rolls any ones, then the GM gets to add a die to the Doom pool.
Oh.
And the Doom pool
helps Dr. Doom.
Potentially, but it is more like plot points for the GM.
Ah, okay.
That's, you know, that's basically the entire system in a nutshell.
That's nice. I like it.
And plot points let you do special things, like some powers activate on plot points or add more dice to your result. The way damage is handled is different. If you are damaged, like that D10, if that D10 got through and damaged the target, then every other time I needed to roll against that target, I would add a D10 to my dice pool because that's the effect that's on him.
I understand. Gotcha.
It's like a hindrance on him.
Right.
So that was a lot of fun. I got to be Spider-Man.
I know. I was reading that on Twitter, and I was like, wow, how lucky is Chris that he got to be Spider-Man?
And that was tons of fun.
I'm sure. How could you not have fun playing Spider-Man?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you when you can not have fun, when you run out of one-liners.
Oh, you see, now, I can't imagine you doing that, but if it happened, I would laugh in your face. I mean, I would
it was
for
touch
it.
And go for it. There are little other effects, like for Spider-Sense on his Spider-Powers power set.
Huh?
You can spend a plot point and get to reroll all your dice if you want to.
Oh, nice, because of spider sets.
And that's, you know, one of Spider-Man's powers.
That's pretty slick.
I got into a fight with Green Goblin, and this is an example of the narrative control that the players have.
Okay.
He threw some pumpkin bombs at me and rolled, you know, X, mm-hmm. and I rolled just shy of X on my defenses.
Oh.
So the GM said, okay, this is what happens to you. And I said, well, how about this instead? He goes, yeah, that's better. Let's, you know, go with that.
Okay.
I felt like, you know, I had helped write the story. I had helped write the comic book that we were making.
That's great. Wow. Fantastic. Jesus, I've been looking at that for years.
Now, I do think there was one slight drawback, and I don't know if it's really a drawback.
Okay.
Because you don't really stick with a character long enough to get sick of it.
Okay.
The only problem that I came up with, or that I could really find with the system, is that a single turn takes a long time because I'm going through all my dice pools looking for the most appropriate thing for the situation. Then the target is going through all his dice pools looking for the most appropriate thing for the situation. Then the dice are rolled. Then the dice are chosen. Then the, you know, it's a little bit long for a turn.
Right.
But it didn't feel like I was waiting too long for my turn.
You didn't feel bogged down by it.
I really didn't. And the thing is, like, the reason why I didn't is because I was listening to every other person's turn at the table, and it was all just very exciting.
Which is fantastic. I mean, that's what it should be about, you know?
I got to be Spider-Man, nanny, nanny, boo-boo.
Well, you keep saying things like that, and I'm afraid I'm just going to have to come down there and do bad things to you. Mister? Okay, I'm better now. Sorry.
Okay. Got that out of your system?
It's out of my system now.
I was really nervous about running.
Mm-hmm.
Story be or the game because I wasn't really sure how the system worked when it was all played out.
Right.
I've seen it in action and I really enjoyed it and I'm ready to run it.
Fantastic.
So yeah, come down here.
I'll come down for Christmas.
Okay. Did you have any games? You want to go straight to the news?
I really didn't have any gaming. Unfortunately, my game is on hiatus. I'm not exactly sure why, but I'm sure there's a good reason for it. I'm trying to think if there was anything else I wanted to add. No, I haven't had a chance to start gaming with my son yet because we've both been very, very busy with other parts of life. But it looks like probably within the next 2 weeks we will be starting the Lord of the Rings meets Star Wars burning wheel game.
Sounds awesome.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, you're going to tell us about it when it happens,
oh,
right?
Oh, definitely.
Awesome. Okay.
Okay.
Well, then let's get into the news.
Hop into the news.
It is time for the news.
Hey, one brief news item.
Do tell.
Do you remember when we were talking about the little engine that could, that Kickstarter from Reaper?
Yes.
The Bones miniatures package,
yes,
deal?
Indeed.
Well, when we talked about them last, they had a $30,000 goal,
right,
and they had reached $400,000+ already from backers.
Man.
They had 2 weeks or more left when we said that.
Right.
On August 25th, they finished their fundraising goal, the Kickstarter, with a grand total of $3,429,236 of their $30,000 goal.
We are in the wrong gig.
I think it's time for you and me to start a Kickstarter.
I think we should kickstart where we hit the body.
I have a plan.
Tell me your plan.
We are going to start a Kickstarter,
okay,
to buy you and me,
uh-huh,
cottages in the Bahamas,
okay,
and I think some decent podcasting equipment.
Oh, that would be great.
And, you know, one or the other, you know, what our goal could be, you know, call it a cool dollar. So no matter what we raise, we reach our goal.
There you go.
And then everything else is gravy.
There it is.
But we have to tell our backers where the money's going.
Oh, that's going to be problematic. I just feel it.
I think I have two words, the Bahamas.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. There you go.
So, yeah, we are clearly in the wrong line of work.
Definitely. Jeez.
But that means that those Bones minis will be coming out. And if you were a backer, if you were pledged at the vampire level, the $100 level, you have a boatload of minis coming to you.
I'm sure.
I think it ended up being about 250 minis.
Wow.
And they're plastic, but they're based on the same molds that the metal Reaper minis are based on.
Right.
And there's just tons and tons of minis.
Can we get a hold of the Reaper guys and ask them what it was like to realize they'd gotten that much funding? You know, what do you do when you sit there and say, oh, we need $30,000, and you break that by two orders of magnitude?
I will, yeah, I would be wondering what they would say to that, because that's a lot of money for anybody, especially,
oh, yeah,
when they put up a rather modest $30,000 goal.
Oh yeah.
And a lot of projects with a tenth of that don't get funded at all.
Oh, no, they don't. Oh, and Better Angels made their goal too.
Oh yes, yeah, I pledged on that one too.
Cool.
I also pledged on Monty Cook's. That ends actually today, so there's really no point in going into it.
Okay.
Monty Cook is doing a new role-playing game on his own after he left the D&D Next. It is Numenera, and it looks like he's trying to do some new things with, you know, game mechanics and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So your character generation is, I am an adjective noun that verbs.
Okay.
And that's your concept.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, check it out. It bears investigation.
I'm
and
sure
I'm
yeah,
going to see, you know, because, you know, basically Monty Cook's name on a book is going to sell it to me usually.
Okay, fair enough.
Because he's done so many different things with gaming.
Yes.
That if he's doing something where he's trying to be different, I want to see what it is.
I'm curious as well. I have to say that it does pique my curiosity. I may not back it, but I'll definitely look at the final product.
Mm-hmm. So that will be coming out next summer, I believe it says there.
Oh, nice.
The minis, if you pledged on Reaper, you can expect your minis to arrive in the mail sometime around March.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, we'll try to get Reaper on the show.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And if not, I will do whatever I can. I will pretend to be from Reaper.
I will look into it and see what we can see what I can find as well.
Okay, you might know some people.
Yeah, see if I've got a connection somewhere.
Sure. Okay. That's all the news that I had.
All right. So that is all the news that is news.
This is the heart of the matter. Well, you know, Pete, last week, or last show, we talked about playing evil.
Yes.
As players playing in an evil campaign, playing evil in a regular campaign. And, you know, one of the things we pointed out was that it's not always right for every single campaign for there to be an evil gamer.
That's true. That's true.
But, you know, I've noticed there's always one player who has to show up to the table, and he always seems to have to play the bad guy, and we've got a word for that. You know what we call him?
Chris. No, I mean the Game Master.
Yes.
Yes.
The Game Master.
Yes, indeedy.
The Game Master is under the obligation to always oppose the players.
I had an interesting thought, linking back to that statement, which is that when you and I had talked earlier, I think about canned adventures, maybe, we had mentioned that one of the problems that you had faced was that the players did not want to interact with the NPCs.
Yes.
And that was because they did not inherently trust the NPCs due to being stung in prior adventures with the same game master.
Yeah, NPCs started out with the very suspicious reputation fashion style.
Right,
yeah.
And I find it interesting that both you and our friend Ron suffer from that same kind of stigma. And I think part of it may be because, you know, some of us go in playing the villain because we need to, and some of us do it because we like to.
Mm-hmm.
So, just throwing that out there.
Yeah, that's a good thought. And I have tried to make NPCs that are completely and totally on the players' sides, or have, you know, goals that, you know, dovetail with the players' goals, doesn't always mean that the players will consider them friends.
True. Very true.
However, as the game master, we are constantly given the challenge of creating a bad guy, creating something to oppose the heroes.
The antagonist.
Something for the heroes to oppose, actually, is really kind of where we're going.
That's true. I mean, we have to come up with a decent antagonist or series of antagonists in order to keep the game engaging.
Right. And every story, whether it's a single session or a one-shot, it kind of has to have, you know, a goal, and that goal is usually a villain.
Right.
And to overcome a villain, to defeat a villain... And basically a villain has to be a little bit more than just a series of stats that represent opposition to the party.
True. Very true. To be an engaging villain, you need to breathe some life into him or her,
right,
as the case may be.
Or her. Yeah, absolutely. And, he has to be more than just the toughest monster in the dungeon. And
right,
he has to be more than just the person with the most hit points at the bottom level of the caves or the dungeon or whatever.
Right. Of the catacombs.
Well, right. I mean, you know, if you want something that feels organic and fully developed, I mean, I guess there's nothing wrong with, you know, making it like kind of a video game sim or a hack sim.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it is the boss monster at the bottom of the dungeon who is the toughest guy that, you know, is a challenge that is supposed to challenge every number on your sheet.
Right.
Which, you know, you can do.
I mean, it's legit, and I see the legitimacy in it. It's just that I feel like if I'm going to play that game, there have been so many video games that do it so well. Why not just play one of those?
Yeah, exactly. And
so.
I don't want to knock somebody who does want to sit at a table and, you know, and play that kind of game.
No, not at all. I mean, everybody's got their own thing, and that.
Right. Sometimes
thing,
that's all you're in the mood for. Sometimes you've had to, you know, challenge your brain all day at work or, you know, for other reasons, and you just want to sit down and beat things up, and that's cool.
And take their stuff, yes.
Yeah, beat things up, take their stuff.
Yep.
But I think it's a challenge, it's a constant challenge for me as a GM.
Mm-hmm.
To make up memorable bad guys, and it's something we have to do a lot.
True.
So.
Very true. And we have to do it well, or else we don't play.
Yeah.
You know? So.
So a villain should really be somebody working the same adventure as the players, but from the opposite side.
Ideally, yes.
We can pattern a villain off of lots of famous, memorable villains from fiction and film.
Do you happen to have a few of those in mind?
I do, actually. There are a lot of villains in film stories, lots of media that stick out as being memorable, and we want to have that kind of reaction from our players. We want them to remember the bad guy that we gave them.
Right.
The first one that actually came to mind is not somebody who, controls galaxies or moves, great forces beyond the ken of mortal man.
Mm-hmm.
The first memorable bad guy that popped into my mind was Hans Gruber.
Which is a phenomenal bad guy.
I thought he was fantastic.
He really is. He's wonderful. He riffs, he does all sorts of stuff. It's just really, it's a very strong bad guy, I think.
Yeah, and he came in with a double blind going on. He was like kind of presenting this face to keep people distracted so he could do what he really wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And he was just gallons of style.
Yes.
Going on. And so that's the first one that popped into my mind.
And he's got some of the most phenomenal lines. I just love the part when he looks at Bonnie Bedelia and says, "No, Mr. Gennaro, I'm a most extraordinary thief." That kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly. Every single line he has is fantastic.
It is, and he delivers it with such enjoyment,
Mm-hmm.
So.
But when I was trying to come up with a list off the top of my head, the second one that popped into my head is Darth Vader.
Oh, yeah.
And while I was thinking about what made Darth Vader memorable, it was really kind of all about his aura. He had this aura of menace.
Oh, yeah. When he walked into the room, he owned it.
Right,
totally
exactly.
Did.
And it's kind of odd because he didn't really do that much in the story. He wasn't controlling, the story from the bad guy's side.
No, that's true.
But he just seemed to have this sort of threat about him.
Mm-hmm.
And he remains the bad guy until the Emperor becomes the clear bad guy, and then he becomes not the bad guy.
Honestly, the whole reason why you give the Emperor any props whatsoever is because he's the one that Vader bends knee to.
Uh-huh.
That's the legitimacy right there. It's not that it's not that he comes out like, "Oh, I'm so evil." It's an old man in corduroy, for God's sakes.
Yes.
And you don't feel like he should be this incredible bad guy, but the minute Vader sees him, he's down on one knee. And that
right.
says something. And he calls him master, And this uh-huh. is this is a guy who can force joke you from one starship to another.
Yeah.
So
over a video screen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But Darth Vader really is just an aura of threat.
Oh yeah.
Until roughly in the third movie, mm-hmm. In my opinion, Luke kind of rehumanizes him with his, he's, "I'm not gonna kill you, I'm gonna bring you back."
Right,
I'm gonna
the whole
save
redemption
you.
Thing. Yeah.
Right. And I think that kind of, that element of a plot arc is important for a villain. That kind of possibility is important.
Oh, yeah. The possibility of redemption, always a big seller.
Yeah. But I kind of felt that when that became clear that that was what Luke was going to do, then Darth Vader wasn't really the villain anymore.
Well, plus when he throws the Emperor down the exhaust shaft, that's kind of a giveaway.
Well, yeah. I mean that very, that kind of awkward, uncomfortable elevator ride.
Yes. Yes. So...
So, what came to your mind?
What are you guys doing in the Death Star for fun? Oh,
Yeah. Old horse choking people.
Be careful of that. Right. That's quite hot. Is it?
Yeah, like you. what came to your mind when this list was presented?
When we were talking about it, besides Hans Gruber, of course, the one villain who always made me go, "Yay," was Kaiser Soze.
Mm-hmm.
From Usual Suspects.
Right. And I have a confession.
Yes.
I only watched that movie because you mentioned him last show.
Yes, I know. We talked about this. It makes me smile. I'm glad you
did. Yeah, that's one of those movies that I hadn't seen yet. It was like, I've heard this is good. I already knew the spoiler. It's
right.
Like, oh, this guy's Kaiser Soze. I'm not even going to spoil it.
Yeah, but his delivery is just...
Oh, it was good. It was really good. And even knowing the spoiler going in, it didn't ruin the movie for
me.
Right,
exactly. So.
But yeah, very stylish, very cool,
mm-hmm.
Very sly.
Oh, very. So manipulative. Beautifully
uh-huh.
manipulative,
Right.
Brings so many different elements into play. You know, it's just really, he's such a consummate puppet master.
Mm-hmm.
He makes such a great villain as a result, mm-hmm. you know. And then again, he's gone, just like that.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. And
off to wreak more evil.
Yeah, and you know, is there going to be a sequel for him?
Never,
you know?
Thank goodness.
Yeah, but it's you know, in the universe of the movie, I mean, what's he going to do next? You know, where's he going to go from there?
Oh, but the best part about that is it doesn't matter because you can write what happens next. You know, you can come up
sure.
with all this awfulness that he can do. You know, this is uh-huh. just one small snapshot of a greater, you know, mm-hmm. greater series. So.
Yep. So he made a memorable bad guy just because it was this big reveal at the end.
Very much so.
And it still works even if you know what's going to happen.
Yes.
Even if you know the secret.
Very much so. Yes.
Because you look at it and you go, huh, oh, you dog.
And very few movies make me do that. I know the one time that it made us do it simultaneously was watching Hancock. And Charlize Theron punches Will Smith through the house.
Yep, I did not expect
that. Oh, yeah, we both went, huh. How about that?
I did not see that coming. Okay.
No, neither did I.
All right. So, so that's, you know, that was another memorable bad guy. Well, what else do we have?
Bullseye, one of my favorite bad guys.
That was actually the comic series where Frank Miller gave the story of Bullseye and the death of Elektra. That was one of the first comic stories I read over several issues.
Phenomenal.
I can't. That was about. That was either early 80s or late 70s. I can't remember which.
That was
but
early 80s.
Okay. But that was the first really grown up story I saw in comics. And comics became very serious at that point for me. It became like something you could really do something in.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, that was one of the things that just tore my face right off, you know. And then he followed that up with The Dark Knight Returns, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a very clear evolution of comics right there, and I think Frank Miller was kind of at the forefront with this story.
Yes. No, he was doing the whole kind of deconstruction and looking into motivations and whether or not motivations are pure, and
right.
just coming up with a way that the bad guy screws with the good guy, you know?
Right, and that was the absolute
personal spot, you know?
Right, right. And that was the absolute end of the four-color comic for me.
Oh, no, and I don't blame you, because that's really when stuff really started to change, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You still had some people who hung on to it, like John Byrne and Chris Claremont, but you still had,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
You still,
but
really just, I guess, I don't know. Marvel had always been kind of tiptoeing along that
mm-hmm.
with concepts like, you know, the whole facing racism with the X-Men and Spider-Man's
right.
best friend is addicted to heroin and things like that.
Oh, you know, in the 70s, DC did it too. I remember this one cover of the Green Arrow finding his friend as a junkie. And, you know, it's like in the 70s, there were a lot of...
It was his son.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. I can't remember. I didn't read DC back then, so
right.
I didn't know. But, yeah, I mean, in the 70s, there were a lot of times where comics really tried to be serious and add these sort of real-world issues, but they never really kind of worked.
Well, they never went
the
distance with them. They never touched on the real underlying causes
right.
and themes of that. So
right. they tried to be serious, but they always got something wrong about what they were being serious about.
Yes. Yes. Good.
So if you were really someone who related to the thing that they were talking about, it kind of felt hollow and insincere.
And weak, quite frankly. It just
yeah.
wasn't strong writing.
Right. You know, but they were trying. But I think with Bullseye, I mean, you know, with, you know, killing Elektra and that iconic image of him stabbing her.
Oh, yeah.
It's just going to stay with me forever.
You see, and the funny thing is the one that's going to stick with me is the scene where Matt Murdock as Daredevil is crouching on the hospital bed of Bullseye, and Bullseye is awake and aware of him being there, and he's got a gun, and he's paralyzed from the fight that he had with Daredevil, and Daredevil starts playing Russian roulette with them. And it's just, oh my God, what a powerful issue. You know, I'm
right.
completely blown away by it. I actually have that one sealed in plastic. I like that issue so much.
Yeah.
You know?
So I think that story kind of led into there being a possibility for Dark Knight Returns. And I think without Dark Knight Returns, we wouldn't have had Watchmen.
Yeah. Alan Moore had written Watchmen and stuff like that prior to Dark Knight Returns, but I don't think we would have had it mainstream American okay. did. He was already touching on that mainstream with Marvel Man, also known as Miracle Man, in the UK, but he wasn't going through with it so much in the States. And so when they wanted to bring it in, they said, you know, well, what are you working on? And he said, well, what have you got? And they said, well, we've just acquired this, you know, this one company. You want to do something with those characters? So, and he did. You know, that's where the Watchmen came from.
Okay. Well, one of the more memorable bad guys for doing something against the grain of the classic bad guy was, for me, Ozymandias from Watchmen.
Oh, yeah.
Who, for me, was a memorable bad guy because he was smart enough not to tip his hand until after the job was done.
Smartest guy in the morgue.
Yeah.
No, he was. And that's the thing. That's where it comes home, is the fact that they talk about exactly how incredibly smart he is, and then he shows you how incredibly smart he is by not tipping off the good guys that this stuff is already going down.
Yeah.
You know, he's telling them after the fact, and that's wonderful.
Uh-huh. Going straight from memorable, what else do we have?
One of my big villains is Galactus.
I find him to be memorable. I'm not sure I ever really understood Galactus, because he's more powerful than everybody else in the Marvel Universe combined.
I think one of the things I like about him, and he isn't, but one of the things that I like about him is that he's a force of nature.
Yes,
he's a personification of nature, and not enough conflict happens where the bad guy is a force of nature.
Right.
You know, they'll sit there and they'll give him the props like, oh, you know, he's so bad, he's a force of nature, but he isn't. Actually, and Galactus is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'll go along with you there.
So,
And do they ever actually beat him, or do they just convince him to leave?
Many times they convince him to leave, but apparently during the Annihilation storyline, the whole reason why Terminus is winning is because he's managed to capture Galactus and use him as a power source.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the Silver Surfer and a crew have to go let him loose.
All right.
So...
Yeah, that's on my list, and that's actually coming out for the Marvel Heroic role-playing game.
Yes, my buddy Judd is working on that right now.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually mentioned his name to Dave, and we mentioned getting him on the show, getting Judd on the show, and he said, "Oh yeah, he should have a lot to talk about. We keep him busy."
Oh yeah. Oh, he stays busy anyway. I mean, he's one of the most active people in the community that I've ever known.
Uh-huh.
And I've watched him evolve into that, so that's really been something.
Yeah.
And
I think we would be remiss if we did not mention, if we did not give a nod to our the iconic bad guys of the two subjects of our argument.
Yes.
our running argument. So I think, you know, Lex Luthor and the Joker are both, you know, the principal villains of their respective, you know, superhero storylines.
Oh, very much
you
so.
Know, Lex,
and memorable.
And I think memorable, and I think for a reason.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
And I think I will talk about Lex Luthor.
Okay, please.
Because in my opinion, he's Superman's most memorable and most effective bad guy, because he is the one problem that Superman can't just beat with punches.
Exactly.
He's the one that he forces Superman to use his brain to either outwit or just come up with a way around Luthor's plan.
Well, that's the thing, is that Lex Luthor is like one of the top three most intelligent guys in the DC universe, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. And as a villain, I think he makes Superman better than just somebody who goes around punching things, because he is a god. He can deadlift Mount Washington.
Oh, yeah.
And not break a sweat. What do you do? What do you challenge a guy like that with?
Oh, yeah.
Brains.
Oh, completely.
And so I think Luthor as a bad guy, I feel, elevates Superman to a story that can be relatable.
Yes.
In my opinion.
Oh, completely. Completely.
So that's my opinion.
And it's a damn good one. And I think that I like, one of the big things for me, for a villain, is motivation. And I like Luthor's motivation. I like the fact that he thinks that he's the one foil to keep Superman from taking over.
Right. Whether he likes him or not,
right.
There's a power that needs to be in check.
Yeah, exactly. And he's, by golly, the one to keep it in check. He's the
He's
the one who understands power, he's the ultimate power broker.
Right.
So.
And we can't really judge modern interpretations of the iconic bad guys from stories in the 40s and 50s because they were all kind of, I'm just going to steal all the pies.
Right.
Exactly. Whatever.
Hostess fruit pies.
But, I mean, properly written, these bad guys can really elevate the story to literature.
And they can, which is what brings me to the Joker, and that is the fact that he is such a great villain because he's the antithesis of the hero whom he's, who he opposes.
Uh-huh.
He is
logic.
Bright. He is bright. He is garish. He is crazy. He's everything that Batman is not. And he helps define Batman on a lot of levels as a result of it. And, mm-hmm. It's not just something like the Dark Knight movie that helps you see that. It's Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum.
Mm-hmm.
It's so many different writers, so many different times helping define Batman by how bad the Joker is. And the Joker is just awful. I mean, he's an awful human being.
I think Heath Ledger's interpretation of the character was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
But I also love The Killing Joke is my favorite Batman story.
Oh, with good reason.
Of all time.
Yeah, Alan Moore and Brian Boland. You can't go wrong.
It's just fantastic.
Oh, it is.
And there's a lot of, character examination you can do juxtaposing these two characters together.
Mm-hmm.
And that starts out with an acknowledgement of that. It's, Batman goes to the asylum to talk to the Joker, and he says, we're going to do this until one of us is dead, or we're both dead.
Right. We're not going to stop until we're both dead.
Right.
And the way that it ends is phenomenal, too. I guess I won't spoil it in case people haven't read it, but it's got one of the best endings as well. And that's
we already spoiled Watchmen.
That's true. I mean, I think that probably the Joker telling a joke that they both laugh at is probably the best. That's one of the best mm-hmm. endings I've ever seen. One of the parts that I liked about Arkham Asylum, though, was the fact that, they take the Joker. Grant Morrison takes the Joker to such a different level. Mm-hmm. his perversion and his evil is such a different thing.
Is that the one with the Sienkiewicz art?
Not Sienkiewicz. Dave, isn't that David McKean?
Oh, okay. Okay.
It might be Sienkiewicz.
Dave McKean. I don't know. I don't think I've read that one, but I like both of those artists.
Yes, no, but one of the things about it that I liked was at one point they've got him in the asylum and unconscious, and one of the inmates says, "Let's see his face," and Joe says, "Don't be an idiot, that is his face."
Oh, nice!
And it's just such a great moment,
It is. Just, it sounds like it. I'm gonna have to get that then.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these things are, memorable bad guys for various different reasons.
Oh, yeah.
And, these things can apply to, your enemy, the bad guy you set up in your campaign or your story or your mini campaign or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think any of those can be used for, inspiration.
True.
To draw from that. But I think you can also have a villain who's not a villain.
Okay. Do tell. And elucidate on that, if you would be so kind.
I will cite from literature the policeman Javert from Les Miserables.
Oh, nice.
Who I feel is a villain, but if in terms of Dungeons and Dragons, he's a lawful good villain.
Nice.
And he's only a villain because he thinks that the hero is a villain. He's
right.
Just wrong, and that's what makes him the antagonist.
That's good.
And that can also make a good villain in a campaign. And in fact, I based one of the characters in my homebrew campaign on a combination of Javert and J. Jonah Jameson.
Oh, no kidding. That's a fun combination.
It was, actually. where he was really suspicious of all the characters.
Right.
He knew they were up to something. He was going to get to the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
Chased them across the town when they tried to flee, captured them, got them to, and the heroes or the characters in the game were like, this is a bad situation. We're caught by the bad guy. We're going to, something bad is going to happen. And he took them into a room one by one and interrogated them about what was going on. He was basically looking for heretics.
Right.
And you were, I don't think you were at that session, but you were there for this part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So he interrogated them because he knew that somebody knew something.
Right.
And what's really funny is that not all of the characters actually did know something, but some of them did.
That's great.
In character. I think out of character, they all knew what was going on, but I'm pretty sure in character, there were some people there who were like, why are you chasing us? Why are we running? Guys.
That's great, though. I think that really brings home, I think that kind of villain brings home one of the things about villainous motivations that we'll, you know, we can go into next,
uh-huh.
but also brings what I like most was when he was being interviewed about playing the Green Goblin, Willem Dafoe said, you know, why do you feel like the Green Goblin is such a strong character? How do you portray him so strongly? And he said, it doesn't matter, you know, good or bad, everybody's righteous.
Exactly.
And I think that really, I think Javert and I think the character you're talking about really send that home. I think there's a level of righteousness there that blinds them to everything else.
And the character that I used, like Javert, was truly interested in seeing good done, good accomplished.
Yes, exactly. It was
and when
the end
interrogated,
that he was going for.
Right. He interrogated the characters one by one, and when the priest came in, when he brought the priest into the room for interrogation, he dropped to his knees and asked for a confessional.
Right. Yeah. No, I remember.
He sought some guidance from the priest because he was confused. He knew that something was wrong about what the people were saying, but they didn't seem like bad people.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically petitioned the priest for forgiveness and counsel.
There you go.
You know, the cleric of the party.
That's fantastic. I think that's wonderful.
So those are villains that I have taken inspiration from and applied to games that I've run.
Same here.
Where else can we go with that?
I'm not sure that we can. I think we should look at what makes a villain a villain.
Well, we were talking about earlier about the faceless villain.
Oh, we were talking about forces of nature, right? And the other one that we can come up with is that some villains don't have to be a single person; they can be an entity,
right?
Like like Enron,
mm-hmm. right? I believe Pentex was the name of the corporation that was doing all the evil things in the world in the werewolf game.
That's true. There was also wasn't Mars ruled by an evil corporation in Total Recall?
Probably. I don't remember well enough.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is a villain you can't put a face to. You can't go up and punch Pentex. You can't go up and punch, you know, a corporation.
Yes.
You can't shoot. You can't backstab Enron.
You can't charm.
Right. And so that kind of adds a different that kind of changes the focus of an antagonist. That kind of changes how a story works.
There's actually a game called Misspent Youth in which the antagonist is in fact a faceless establishment.
Well, there you go.
That's kind of the whole basis of the game is that you create, you know, the players and the GM get together and they create who it is that's messing with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to figure out a way to buck the system or bring them down.
Right. Okay. Well, that's the way you play that game.
That is the way you play that game. That is one of the primary focuses in the game, which I think is wonderful. I've played it a couple of times and I've enjoyed it all of my sessions.
And what is that called? I think you blurred out on the name.
Misspent Youth.
Awesome. Yes. We will check into it.
Okay.
You can pull inspiration for your bad guy from any one of those or, you know, just anything that has a bad guy. You can pull from the most popular, you know, books or films, you know, like Voldemort. You can have your bad guy be a Voldemort clone and just change his name in certain things and, you know, people won't recognize him.
But of course, calling him Voldemort, not so much very exciting.
Not so much. Yeah. Tom
Arnold.
No, whatever.
Tom Arnold.
Whatever his name is. I'm not sure. I didn't finish the book.
With good reason.
Well, I mean, would you say Voldemort was a good villain or a bad villain?
I'd say that Voldemort was a good villain in that he was he kept coming back and he always had a different plan
uh-huh.
the time that he came back. I just think that the big thing about him is that you know if he manages to come back to power, it's just going to be terrible for everybody.
Mm-hmm. I actually wouldn't have included him on this list of great bad guys.
Right. I don't think he's a great bad guy, but I think he's an okay bad guy.
Yeah. My main reason is like after he kills everybody and wins, what does he want?
Ice cream.
Because
pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, there's still the separation of magic world and real world.
True.
And if, you know, if any of the wizards had just gone to school with a gun, you know.
Well, no, he was. That was his whole thing, was that he was going to rule the entire world, both the wizarding world and the normal world.
Mm-hmm.
And so he punished, you know, muggles all the time. He didn't have a problem with it. He violated the earliest and biggest tenet of being a wizard.
Uh-huh.
You know, is he you know, he went through the veil all the time.
Okay. Well, if, you know, so good but not great, you think?
Yeah, good but not great.
Okay. So you could do that. You could just reskin Voldemort.
Oh yeah, easy.
What else?
One of my favorite ones is from anime. It was a guy called Million Knives from Trigun.
Okay. Haven't seen that one, but I'll take your word for it.
One of the cool things about it is that
it's good about him.
He's the he's kind of like the Joker. He's the polar opposite of the hero.
Uh-huh.
But he wants destruction on a worldwide scale.
Okay.
He thinks that human beings are a virus. You know, he's kind of like Agent Smith in that regard. He just thinks that they need to be picked out and gotten rid of.
I was going
to
say, where else did I hear that? Oh, yeah, that's a movie that I saw.
Yes. But, yeah, so that's... I think anime is rife, actually, with really good villains.
And
it's also rife with ones that have been, you know, that are hackneyed and,
sure,
and overdone. But I think that, you know, you've got guys like him, and then you've got, you know, like Count D from Pet Shop of Horrors, whose great weakness is that he loves chocolate.
Uh-huh. And if you've been watching Last Exile, Lord Dio is interesting as a middle phase of the story villain, because
mm-hmm.
You're not quite sure what he's doing, what he's there for.
Right.
Speaking of anime, I'm not sure if you consider Avatar The Last Airbender anime, because it's an American production,
yeah,
as far as I know.
But it's, you know, the work is...
It's definitely in the style.
Yeah, it works in Korea. I mean, it all depends on...
One thing I like about that
series... I guess
since
it's based on a manga, we can't really consider it anime.
Okay.
So,
One thing I really like about that series is that the villain from season to season changes.
Yes.
Like, but the characters, they don't actually beat the villain to move on to the next one. It's like the person you thought was the bad guy, well, he's not really that bad.
Right.
It's really this person.
Yeah, it's actually...
And then you get to this person. What's that?
It's actually his sister.
Yeah. Oh, well, she never stops being a bad guy, but then they actually...
No, but she's not the worst one. You think you can't get worse than her, and then season three comes up, and it's like, oh, no, there is somebody worse than her.
Right, exactly. Because in the first season, you think Zuko, wow, Zuko's a real jerk. I hope, you know, they beat him up and take his stuff.
Right.
Or whatever, you know, whatever they need to do to defeat that villain.
Yeah.
But he's got this little Jiminy Cricket, Uncle Iroh, mm-hmm. you know, whispering in his ear, and you find out, well, Zuko's not really the bad guy. He's just kind of young and confused, and he's got a chip on his shoulder.
Yes.
And then it kind of focuses to his sister and then to his father. And it's just a very, very well-done transition of who the real villain is.
And the cool thing about it is I think that there's a real underlying weakness in Azula.
Uh-huh.
That finally it builds and builds and builds until she finally crumbles, because she's really creating the house of cards that she thinks is a fortress.
Right, and it's
and
pretty.
Really
it becomes clear that she's evil primarily because she is broken.
Oh yeah, very much so.
But hey, spoilers, right?
Right. Good point. We do that a lot.
Yeah. So let's. Oh, you know what? I thought of a bad guy.
Tell me.
Could it be
Satan? Oh, the church lady.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
So good bad guy. I mean. There's been more stories told with him as the bad guy than any other single bad guy in the history of literature.
Hey, if not for him, Faust would just merely be an interesting name.
Exactly. Yes, I couldn't have said it better myself. And what makes him a memorable bad guy? I mean, there's a lot of literature possibilities you can do with Satan.
Oh, and you can go the whole gamut with him. That's the best part, is that since he's the ancient and eternal evil. You know, you can make him as mean, nasty, and powerful as you want to, or as weak and vulnerable and approachable as possible, you know? And the best part about it is you don't know if he's just screwing with you.
And you could tell stories from his point of view or, you know, other people's point of view. And like one of the, actually just came up today, one of my favorite Sandman stories is the one where he quits.
Yes, me too. One of my favorite ones when the Sandman sends Kane to see him. And he says, Satan says to Kane, still, it is better to rule in hell, eh? And he goes, what have you say, my lord? And he goes, no, we did not say this. Milton said this. And Milton
right.
blind. And that's
yep.
all.
Yep. And I like that speech he gives to Morpheus when he's saying, you know, they take my name and they say that I made them do this and, you know, all this other stuff. And I've never made one of them do anything.
Nope. It's all free will, baby.
That's a great little soliloquy there.
Oh, it is.
So, yeah. So memorable bad guys, you can steal any of those.
Oh, yeah. And Satan, of course, like I said, just you can see, do so much with Satan.
Sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. Viggo Mortensen playing Satan in the movie The Prophecy was a lot of fun.
Yes, a whole lot of fun.
Because he's just scary.
Yeah, he is. I mean, he's, you know, Christopher Walken's great because he chews the sets and everything, but as soon as Viggo Mortensen shows up, it's like, oh, that's, yeah. Yeah, he's
right,
all kinds
right.
of bad.
Yeah, I just got that on Blu-ray. I'd seen it before, but I just got it because I want to remember his speech.
Oh.
And I also want to memorize Walken's lines about what it means to be an angel.
You know, I got to tell you, the other Satan who I really enjoy, and uh-huh. a lot of people may poo-poo me for saying so, but I can't remember the actor's name. He played Satan in Constantine in that awful, awful version of Hellblazer. With
I didn't see it.
Peter, give me a sec. I'm going to IMDb it real quick.
Okay.
But he's wonderful, Satan, because he's a Satan who loves his job.
Oh, okay.
And that brings me joy. It just does when you got a bad guy who clearly likes what he's doing, you know? And one of them is coming to collect Constantine's soul because he's finally dying and all the times that he couldn't, you know, grab him before.
So are you saying the movie's
Peter
worth
Stormare.
Because of it? Okay.
Just for that, if you want to, I'm pretty sure probably you can find it on YouTube or Vimeo or something like that. Just the scene where Satan and Constantine have this one talk.
Okay.
And as he shows up, he's dripping corruption.
Uh-huh.
This black tar just rolls off of him, and it starts to eat away through everything and infect everything around him. And it's
wonderful. Okay.
But Peter Stormare is the one who plays Satan in that, and he clearly enjoys his work.
So worth it for that scene, you say?
Yes, very much so.
Awesome.
Not worth it for the rest of the movie, but worth it for that scene.
Well, okay. I'll look for that scene.
Yes.
So all of these villains, if you can throw any of them in there, but they need something else.
Yes.
They need more than just this inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
They need two things.
Motivation. What is my motivation?
What's my motivation? What do they want? Their goal is really what they want.
That's true. And what is their goal?
So their goal and their motivation are both important things, and they may be different.
Yes. Yes, they may.
I mean, their motive, they want a goal, and their motivation is why they want that goal.
Yes.
So, what kinds of things do villains want things for?
Power.
Power's a big one. Power is kind of this nebulous concept of, you know, we see a lot of villains who want to rule the world, and we think, oh, we better stop them from ruling the world, but we don't really have any evidence that they would be bad leaders.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is that, you know, the whole free will and the concept of democracy and things like that, you don't want somebody who's just going to be the hegemony, you know?
Yeah.
You want to stay away from that. You want to give yourself the leeway to be able to make mistakes and make choices and things like that, you know? And him sitting there saying, no, I can do better, you know, that's kind of the really fun giveaway of Dr. Horrible is when he sits there and he goes, you know, because the status isn't quo. The world is broken and I just need to rule it, you know?
Right.
No, you don't. Because...
Well, drawing from history, though, I mean, let's pull from real life. I mean, what was intrinsically bad about Napoleon that made him a worse ruler than King George?
Well, let's see here. King George had pyphoria, and so there was a reason he was acting sketchy. Napoleon was crazy. He was egomaniacal, you know. He just had a completely different, you know, view of the overall world. So
which one would have been, you know, would Napoleon have been a terrible ruler as opposed to any of the nobility of Europe at the time?
I think the primary objection to Napoleon's rule was the fact that he was land hungry. He kept going into other countries and trying to instill, you know, make the Napoleonic Code their ruling law, you know, and it's just not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody needs to have the freedom to do stuff. And that's the thing that kills me with, you know, the concept that one of the things he brought was liberty. No, not necessarily, you know. So I think that's a big part of it. I think that's one of the reasons why you can consider him not such a great ruler.
Right.
You know, and he's the guy who comes up and he makes himself an emperor, you know. So suddenly he is nobility. And he takes the freaking of the Pope's hand and crowns himself. He's like, you know, there's no human being above me. So therefore, ta-da!
Right.
I'm the emperor.
Yep.
Come kiss my ring and speak, you know, kind of thing.
Did he sing it like that? Is there a musical?
I'm writing one.
Oh, but you definitely got to use So power is one thing that motivates villains, and I guess the characters, if they are not also power hungry, are set to oppose this goal. Mm-hmm. Is that a goal or is that a motivation?
I think power is a goal.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it can be a motivation if you're looking for something else. Like, I think, well, let's look at some other ones.
I want this artifact. Why? Because it will give me power.
Yeah. Okay.
That's splitting hairs. That's kind of saying that's just deflecting.
Oh yeah, but if you wanted revenge, and the only way that you can get revenge is by acquiring power.
Sure.
You know, like what's his face? The Count of Monte Cristo.
Uh huh.
You know, look at what he did. You know, revenge. He had to take money, gain influence, gain power, gain a title.
Yeah.
He was able to enact revenge on everybody, pretty much.
Yeah. Pete, spoilers. It's too soon.
Sorry. I've given it a 10.
It's only, I don't know how many centuries it's been, but it's got to be too soon.
It's only been 200 plus years.
Yeah, so so money could be a goal.
Yes, money could be.
Money could be a... It doesn't really seem like a motivation. Why do you want power? Money. Well, maybe you want power because it'll give you lots of money, but then that, again, splits the... you know, it just kind of...
I feel like it's the other way around. I think that
one way or the other.
I think that money is the road to power. I think that it gives
you... Yeah, I think you're right. I'm going to go with you on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and revenge is definitely a goal. That is almost never a motivation.
Oh yeah, no, definitely a goal.
Madness. That doesn't seem like a goal to me.
No, but is it a motivation also?
The goal, it's not a motivation so much as a reason for doing what he's doing.
Yeah, okay.
Uh-huh. And Sharon just piped up from the back of the room, love or lust?
Oh, lust is always a good motivation.
Yeah, both of them are wonderful motivations, and your villain could be powered and fueled entirely by those two things together.
Oh, easy.
Jeez. Or one or the
great.
Other.
Yeah.
Which may lead to madness.
Yes. Or maybe rooted in madness already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, madness is more like it's why he's doing something.
Right.
But it's not really, you know, I will go mad so that I can have power.
That
seems like a kind of a Mad Libs kind of way to go about building your bad guy.
Yeah, I guess madness is kind of the machine, whereas motivation is the fuel and the goal is the destination.
Sharon just gave me another one.
Okay.
She says pride.
Okay.
Pride is your motivation.
Okay.
And she cites the queen in Snow White. She does something because she can't stand the idea of somebody being better than her.
Okay.
So her goal is to eliminate the competition. Her motivation is pride.
Okay.
That seems pretty clear cut, right?
No, that's very clear cut. That's very.
And you could make one. You could build a campaign on that.
You could easily.
Your
as
motivation.
As a matter of fact, I think I have.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. your motivation could be justice.
That's true.
But as Batman has told us, vengeance is injustice.
No.
Not that I've seen those silly Batman movies. He's just a wealthy ninja.
Ha, 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 ha.
I actually haven't seen the Bane movie.
You tell him, pink alien lover.
have you seen the new Batman movie?
I have.
You have.
Yes.
I'm just not a fan of Bane. I mean, the comics Bane is just like, this guy's a Mexican wrestler. How tough is he going
to
be?
I have to tell you, the biggest problem I had with the newest movie was the fact that it was like Christopher Nolan was so in love with the fact that the first two movies were so successful. It's like, look how grandiose and wonderful we are.
Uh-huh.
And here's 40 more minutes of wonderful and grandioseness, you know?
Is that how it comes off?
That's how it came off to me.
Right.
So and the fact that Bane has this great accent where he talks like this. Brothers, we are here to destroy Gotham.
Stay a while and listen.
Exactly. That's the only thing that kept going through my
Deckard
mind.
Deckard Bane.
Was the fact that it was Deckard the whole time. Stay a while.
Deckard
and
Bane. I got it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to kill the Batman.
I don't
know
if
that was kind of like. You know what Deckard Cain is? I don't know if I've said it.
Jimmy Stewart?
It's if Jimmy Stewart and Sean Connery had a kid.
Yeah. Deckard Cain.
He
is
would
like
be Deckard Cain.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Stay a while and listen.
And now Bane.
Well, it looks like you're the man now, dog.
I've ruled the League of Shadows for years now.
We are being silly, and this is getting cut.
Okay. Let's come back.
Okay, and bring it back. Okay.
So we've talked about goals and motivations.
Yeah. So we also talked about the villain being. We mentioned the villain being kind of working the same adventure from the other side, but we haven't really stated the reason that the villain, from his own point of view, the villain, I heard this phrase somewhere, and I can't remember where. It might have been another podcast. It might have been something that is a meme somewhere.
Okay.
But the villain should be the hero of his own story.
Yeah, no, totally. And that's the whole everybody's righteous thing that Willem Dafoe was talking about.
Exactly. And it's that what he's doing, he believes he must do because either nobody else would do it, because it has to be done, because it's right and necessary,
well,
or because
it's the means to the end. You know, it's how he's going to accomplish his goal.
Mm-hmm. And going back to our you know, villain, our memorable villains, Ozymandias wanted to make the world a better place.
And he succeeds. That's the best part.
That is.
He brings together the world for the first time.
Right. And that's, you know, he's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
But what he's doing, he believes is right and necessary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but if you told the story from the villain's point of view, with your adventure that you're building, with this villain that you're building, it should still make sense. Because
mm-hmm.
he shouldn't be, you know, just throwing out bad guys to just do bad things for no real reason. Nobody does that.
Well, I mean, unless you're doing somebody who's the bad guys like the Joker, wherein the craziness is kind of the end in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to sow chaos. That's his big deal.
Okay.
You know, you want to see the world
burn.
Men
just want to see the world burn,
yeah,
right.
Exactly.
This kind of evolved villain is something that I didn't really see for a while, but I first remember seeing it when I was reading Secret Wars in comics.
Oh, yeah.
And it struck me, as this is part of like a gradual process of comics growing up for me and me growing up reading comics,
yes.
was that I first noticed Magneto being placed with the heroes in Secret Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was a hero to his own cause.
Yes. In
and
spite
I think,
of the fact that he headed the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants.
Right. That was an earlier age of comics when it was four color and the villains knew they were villains. Yeah, and it's in retrospect, if they had written, you know, if they had started X-Men, given everything that had happened in comics, if they started X-Men in, you know, the mid-80s when Secret Wars came out,
it would have been so much cooler had the Brotherhood been called the House of M at that point in time.
Yeah, or something.
No,
yeah.
I think that would have been because it's the X-Men versus the House of M, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it would be like the Letter Wars, and they'd be like stealing the keys off each other's typewriters.
And not just that, they would also be going for the consonants, because you can't really do anything without the consonants.
Right. Well, an X is worth 8 and an M is only worth 3.
But what about Z and Q?
Well, they're, you know, you gotta grab them up because there's only one.
I'm just telling you. If you're going to win
the
game.
Actually, M might be worth 4. Now I can't remember.
Say how you are. Okay, but anyway, so making the villain being the hero of his own story is very important. And to me, like, the biggest one for me was when I first read the Invaders comics that Marvel was reprinting, was watching how convinced the Red Skull was that what he was doing was good and right in the way the world should be.
Right.
And that Captain America was, I think he even says that at one point, that Captain America is like the biggest failing of the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think I think that's incredibly telling. You get somebody who drinks Kool-Aid like that, and you can't really
Right.
Fight against him,
right.
You know?
And it's somebody pointed out the irony of sending a 6'4", perfect human, blonde-haired, blue-eyed against, you know, to fight the Nazis and all their terrible ideas.
Right, and the Nazi who they fight is bright red, has a skull for a face,
right.
And has black
eyes.
I think
that was in Pinkerton, Jay Pinkerton.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had some good comics insights.
Yes.
Back in the day. Haven't heard from him
in
about 5 years.
Oh, well.
Sad.
Oops.
It was one of my favorite web columnists, and he just kind of disappeared when he went to work for Valve.
That does happen.
Yeah. So, yeah, and you've got two different kinds of, you know, villains with long-term and short-term. You can run a game where you just have, you know, the freak of the week,
right.
Like in TV style.
Oh, yeah.
Like in a Smallville game or a Supernatural game. It'll just be, you know, these are isolated things that...
Right. Who's the monster you're hunting this week?
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is like... I'm talking about season one of Supernatural, where it really was just Monster of the Week.
Oh, yeah. X-Files was that way, too. You know.
Yeah. And there's a meta plot going on, but this villain is for this piece only, and it's done. And, you know, if your game thrives on episodic stories, that's great. That's fantastic. You probably don't want an overruling bad guy that's at the end of the campaign.
Well, one of the things you have to take into account is that there are some stories that do work with that, and that introduce who the shadowy figure is.
Yeah.
Really, but you don't show who it is until towards the end.
Right,
you know,
right.
You have to, I think as you put it, you have to tier your bad guys.
Yeah, and so. I kind of have this notion of, you know, middle management bad guys kind of controlling a small section of the operation. Like, as I put it in our notes, you know, David Warner is the ultimate bad guy, but in order to get to David Warner, you have to fight your way through David Patrick Kelly first.
Yes.
So, I mean, a bad guy in a structured organization has lieutenants, he has captains, he has, you know, organizations going and doing separate things.
Well,
and
I mean,
in a campaign...
like Kaiser Soze is the best example of that. He's got people all over the frickin' place, you know?
Right.
But he still delivers
where,
by himself from time to time.
Sure. And as, you know, in an epic fantasy campaign where you're playing, let's call it D&D.
Okay.
You know, that's the kind of thing where you're likely to... Yeah, or Pathfinder. You're going to do that every freaking time, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
where you're going to have different tiers of bad guys. You're going to fight, you know, a mind flayer at around level 5 or 6, and, you know, he's going to be overruled by this beholder that you don't even know about, maybe, until you defeat him and look through his notes, and you find that, oh, there's this beholder he's taking orders from.
No.
So
no.
Now he's the bad guy that we're going after.
The point here. You start out meeting the Githyanki, then you meet the you know, the Mind Flayer, then you meet...
Right.
But the flip side to that is what you can do is you can also introduce a bad guy early on, and then it becomes kind of like... Well, it kind of becomes like a Daredevil comic, you know?
Uh-huh.
And that... for the most part, he does the direct conflict with the big bad guy first and either wins or loses, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then other guys come in later, possibly, or he's always focusing on the one bad guy.
Yeah. And the thing is, there's in different styles of game, there is going to be different ways to tier the bad guys. Like you could, if you do a Supers game,
mm-hmm.
you know, you could fight Lex Luthor in the first adventure.
Oh yeah.
And he's going to be your main bad guy for a long, long time.
Right.
You know, or the Joker. You may, in a street level game, you may fight the Joker in your first adventure. You
mm-hmm.
may be opposed to whatever, you know, he may be the bad guy in your first adventure.
Right.
And he's going to be there for a long, long time. And you don't necessarily go through tiers of bad guys so much
mm-hmm.
as, you know, just changing up who the bad guy is for that. You know,
and
that
you kind
story.
Of have to in that situation, because when I ran the Invisible Sun campaign, we had the big bad guy was this evil druid who was a body hopper.
Okay.
And his whole, his whole motivation was he was doing away with elven royalty.
Okay.
And one of the things that he was able to do was become a body hopper. So like they would track his last physical form to a location. And then by then he would have hopped to another body. So they were always kind of one step behind him, and he would always leave like traps and things behind. for them to have to deal with. The other thing that always cropped up was that so that it didn't just become a constant chase of the bad guy, you know, it wasn't constantly, you weren't constantly playing Tommy Lee Jones after Harrison Ford, was that other stuff cropped up as you traveled after this guy, you know, the one biggest one being the murder of Seven Points, where it ended up, it was a poop demon at the end, the excremental.
It was a what?
It was a poop demon at the end.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But in the meantime, you know, they got conscripted into helping solve these murders. You know, there were the people being killed all over town.
Okay.
And so they had to, you know, help out the local people, figure out what was going on, you know? And they ran into other obstacles too. You know, other stuff was going on in the world, but they still, primary focus was trying to track down this evil druid and stop him from killing more elven royalty.
So they kept pop running into him.
Yes, he would pop
different,
up
different ways.
Yes,
okay,
because
that's a great way to do it.
The other fun thing is about him being a body hopper was he could be anybody.
Uh huh.
You know, many times they ran into him and didn't even realize it. At one point, they bought stuff from him.
Oh, nice!
And didn't even realize it was him. You know, that kind of thing. So
I had the one of the main bad guys. I had the players in my homebrew see in the first adventure, and then they just saw him at a distance. He escaped. They found out his name. They found out what he had been doing, and sort of his name has been popping up
mm-hmm.
all through the adventure.
Right.
But they've only encountered him and fought him once, and he has escaped.
I was actually in a thing like that, in that this theocrat of a benevolent deity, the deity ends up being killed.
Okay.
And so the theocrat suddenly becomes this necromantic creature, like he's slowly turning into a lich, and he begins this undead plague. But the plague is to the north of where we are, so we're not really, like, he keeps being mentioned, and situations keep being mentioned. Like, the thing that really brought it home to us that something bad was going on was we were visiting Alum, the Bard College.
Uh-huh.
And one of the guys came up to us and said, "We just lost contact with one of the other colleges."
Huh.
And we're like, "So somebody casts like heavy magics around there or something like that?" No, and they're like, no, you don't understand. We're bards. This is first edition." So they were pretty hefty, you know, beings.
Right.
They had started as thieves and then become fighters, and then they got to become bards.
Yeah.
He's like, "No, you don't understand. We don't lose contact with the other colleges. Something mm-hmm. catastrophic had to have happened for us to lose contact."
Mm-hmm.
"And we want you guys to go and investigate." And that's when we first got to see what was going on. You know, and that was always Dave's kind of big bad guy, was this theocrat who was making the world die because everything mm-hmm. that he had faith in had died.
Okay.
But we, like, early on, like, we were, like, hyper-focused on this one guy who was a grandmaster of thieves, and we wanted to kind of screw with him.
Mm-hmm.
And in return, he screwed with us. And again, it was like one of those things, even going north to investigate the Spard College that they lost communications with, we ran into other stuff, you know?
Uh-huh.
But the big thing was the final big showdown was up on the plains, you know, outside of the human kingdoms, and everybody got together to fight the undead.
Okay.
And
so you had a clear goal from early on, and the campaign was about getting to it.
Ultimately, yes.
Okay.
But I don't think we paid as much attention to it as we should have. I think we were distracted by another thread.
Okay.
But
so
I think
it wasn't the case where you only had one bad guy to identify as a bad guy and you spent too long to get there. Because in my opinion, that could actually make you lose sight of the bad guy. Like if you know at the beginning of a campaign that some epic level villain is behind everything, but there's no way in hell you can fight him until you're like 20th level as, you know, D&D or Pathfinder.
Right. Thank you. Now I've got you doing it.
No, you forced me to do it.
I win.
Bastard. So, I mean, if that is the case, you're going to get bored having this unattainable goal of fighting the bad guy.
Right, and I think that's why Dave pulled it off really, really well when he ran that for us, was because he always had in mind that this was going to be the be-all end-all of the campaign.
Uh-huh.
And I think
But he didn't make it like so much of the focus that you had to obsess on it.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
But he brought it home to us very well. You know, the first time that we walked through a village that's been decimated by the undead, it's really kind of disturbing, especially the way that he described it.
Right. Well, it's, you know, a disturbing notion if you really think about it.
Yeah. So
So let's recap.
Let's what?
Recap.
Oh, recap. Yes.
Yeah, recap. Mm-hmm. We want to help make a memorable bad guy, and I think we have. I think we've achieved that goal, have we not?
I think so. I think we've examples.
We've given examples. We've decided. We've dwelt on what makes a memorable bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned that they should have motivations and goals.
Mm-hmm.
What we didn't mention
was unique character flaws and weaknesses.
We didn't talk about that at all.
No, but I think that we kind of alluded to that in various ways when we talked about different specific villains.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think
so. Give us an example of a villain's unique weakness.
I think Lex's unique weakness is his own ego.
Okay.
I think that's his overwhelming character flaw.
Do you think it makes a villain more memorable to have a flaw like that? Or do you think a villain must have something like that to be fleshed out or unique?
I think it makes him more memorable if he has something unique. Like, the reason why Count D always keeps popping into my mind was because the way that the investigator gets into his shop to investigate the evil things that he's doing is by bringing him baked goods.
Okay.
From this one exclusive bakery. And he's like, oh my God, come in, I'll pour the tea, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's stuff like that. And it's just, it's moments like that that you just sit there and go, that's really clever, you know? It's better that he had to kind of play on the villain's weakness in order to get the hand up on him than to, like you said, the reason why Lex is so great is because he's the one that Superman doesn't get to punch.
Right.
To solve the problem. And I think that's great. I think that really... That's kind of the fun thing about when they started doing the Justice League animated series was that, you know, you had everybody had their own strength they could play into a situation against the character, against the villain's weakness or flaws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and obviously the problem that Superman can't punch, we're obviously not counting the time Lex Luthor gets into the battle suit made of kryptonite.
You had to go there, didn't you?
It's worth mentioning in if only to say, no, we're not talking about
this.
Yes,
please, let us not talk about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that...
That doesn't count.
I think that something, one of the ways that you breathe life into... Exactly. The way that you breathe life into a villain is to give them something that is human and can be played on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
in
definitely.
In this case, it's Joker's crazy, you know?
Yeah.
That's one of the great lines in the Avengers movie, you know, when Wilson says to Loki, you won't win because you're not committed enough.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that's a great point. You know, it's a great line. And even you had said, like, you felt that his plan was kind of weak.
Yeah, it felt kind of half-baked.
And you know? There's a reason for it. It's because he's not committed to it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's really kind of, and Coulson IDs it. He calls it, you know, it's a great... That's a great moment in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, there weren't a lot of great moments in that movie, in my opinion.
I disagree. I think it was a fairly strong movie. I was surprised.
I think too much time was wasted with infighting. I think, you know, getting the heroes to fight each other was like 80 minutes of the movie, and that was just a bit too much, I think.
Fair enough.
But I would have liked to have seen the story develop more, and Loki's whole plan thought about a little harder. Than, you know, than wasting all that time, you know, and it was great to watch. It was really cool, mm-hmm. but it kind of had the feeling of wasting time.
So what did you feel would have made Loki stronger in his villainy?
I think Loki from the movie Thor
mm-hmm.
was the best part of the movie.
Oh, yeah. No, hands down.
Because you really kind of... He was a fully developed character in that movie because he had this sort of, he wanted to belong, and he was hurt that he had been lied to.
Yes.
And, you know, was suddenly realized that he didn't really belong there, that he had this mm-hmm. other heritage that he didn't really understand.
Mm-hmm.
And his motivation was to want to belong anyway.
Right.
In Thor.
Right.
And in the Avengers movie, it just kind of came across as his motivation is to just start some shit.
But I think that is his motivation in it, because now he's not playing his own game. He's playing Thanos' game. Oh, spoiler. Right. Shoot.
Spoiler.
Let me put it this way. He's playing someone else's game. He's not playing his own game. So that's part of the reason why he's not as strong of a villain in that one, because he's not getting to do his own shtick. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, what is Loki best at? Getting people to do the wrong thing of their own free will.
Yeah, pretty much.
Just I don't see how getting a robot army to invade New York fills that goal.
Again, he's not doing his own shtick. That's why. You know, and there are reasons, because he's encountered a force that he's not as great as.
Yeah.
But I think to him, it's a means to an end. If he's able to keep someone, you know, if he's able to keep the unnamed eviler appeased, it will give him the access to Asgard that he wants. And the whole thing could be that this is the way he wanted it from the get-go. He came in weak. He came in appearing different and stuff like that so that he could get back to Asgard, even as a prisoner. Because he knows that once he gets there, you know, he's the best manipulator there.
Yeah, my favorite scene with him in Thor was when he's sitting there consoling Thor about not attacking the Frost Giants.
Yes.
And he's putting the seed in Thor's mind. It's like such a great conversation.
Oh, it's fantastic.
But, I loved Loki in the movie Thor. In fact, he was the only part of the movie that I really loved.
Oh, I like that movie too, but I've always been, I've been a big Thor fan for years. So.
Okay.
I felt like they cut out a half an hour of that show. Oh, sorry.
What's that?
I said I felt like they cut out a half an hour of the storyline.
It did feel kind of rushed.
Yeah. But so he was the best thing you were saying. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I think he was the best part of that movie for me. Right. And just because of things like that.
Yeah.
So, what's the last thing you need to do when you make a villain?
The last thing you need to do when you make a villain is stat him out.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like it's almost an afterthought. And hopefully you won't have to, you know, even have stats for him. To be honest, I have a villain in one of my games that I don't have stats for. Because right now he's just an idea.
I'm going to tell you a little secret. Most of the things that I run don't have stats.
Okay. Most of the villains or most of the games?
Most of the villains.
Okay.
And the reason why is because I want to... I kind of do that. What helps me stat out the villain is how the heroes define the villain.
Okay.
So I kind of do that as a very final thing, you know, even when they're well into the game until I finally start to stat him out and give him, you know, have him fit into the rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, and I've waited until, you know, the week before I thought the party might confront him.
Oh yeah.
To give him stats, and when I write these stats out, I think if they don't confront him at this point in time, this may be completely meaningless.
Oh yeah, and the stats.
I may stat him out completely differently next time.
Okay.
I'm doing this to play fair.
Cool, and that's rocking. I mean, I think that's a good the earmark of a good GM. If you're doing this to play fair and have a good time, I mean, that's what you need to be doing. You know,
right?
That's what we're here
for. Yeah, but I think it's best to retroactively fit the villain to the game system, but don't make your game system define what the villain can do ahead of time.
Yes.
Don't say, you know, I'm playing D&D, so I'm going to make a villain who is a 15th level wizard.
Yes.
You know, wait until the party, you know, has taken their impression of what you've given them and defined him for you.
Exactly. I mean, that's kind of the crux of it. You want to make him what they want to fight.
Yeah, that's absolutely it.
And that's really the big deal, you know? That's kind of why I saved that for last, too.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, so I don't usually put pen to paper or, you know, finger to keyboard because I don't really make up anything that doesn't have software.
Well, there you go. See, I put pen to paper all the time, so.
I might sketch out some notes, but odds are more likely that I will have something on a character generator or a spreadsheet, even if I have to make the spreadsheet myself.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's villainy in a nutshell.
There you go.
Hopefully, we won't get any villains who will email us at rulezeropodcast@gmail.com.
Or will tweet us at rulezeropodcast, yeah.
or like us on Facebook. But if you are a villain and you do like us on Facebook, there is hope for you. You are not irredeemably
exactly.
evil. So go ahead.
We can bring you back. That's the important thing.
Yeah. And, you know, if you need personal consultation as a villain, you can email me at chris@rulezeropodcast.com.
Or me at pete@rulezeropodcast.com.
Or our Gmail address, and we're here for you, villains.
Exactly.
We're here for you.
Exactly. We are.
And on that note, I think we'll wish all villains and GMs a good day.
A good day and a game on.
Game on. Rule Zero Podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. You can use our podcast in your music video or send us to your friends and family, but be sure to mention our names on our website at www.rulezeropodcast.com. Segment and closing music is by Maggie Sansone, used by permission, and is available at maggiesmusic.com.